This is VOA News via remotes. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden said Monday that the U.S. combat mission in Iraq will conclude by the end of the year. It's an announcement that reflects the reality on the ground more than a major shift in U.S. policy. Even before Biden took office, the main U.S. focus has been assisting Iraqi forces, not fighting on their behalf. And Biden did not say if he planned to reduce the number of troops in Iraq now at about 2,500. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani provides more details.
That does not mean that all U.S. troops will be leaving Iraq. There are about 2,500 or so there right now. They will shift strictly to training and advising Iraqi forces.
That's AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani speaking to reporters during an Oval Office session with the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. Biden said his administration remained committed to a partnership with Iraq, a relationship that has not been increasingly complicated by Iranian-backed Iraqi militia groups. South Korea now says that leaders of North and South Korea have agreed to restore suspended communication channels and improve ties. The presidential office in Seoul said that President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un reached such an agreement during several rounds of exchanges of letters that have been occurring since April. The Blue House says the two Koreas tested their communication channel on Tuesday morning. The development comes amid more than 2 years of a stalemate in U.S.-led diplomacy aimed at stripping North Korea of its nuclear weapons. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. The United States served notice Monday that it will keep existing COVID-19 restrictions on international travel in place for now due to concerns about the surging infection rate because of the Delta variant. It was the latest sign that the White House is having to recalibrate its thinking around the coronavirus pandemic as a more infectious variant surges across the U.S. and a substantial chunk of the population resists vaccination. It was also a reversal from the sentiment President Joe Biden voiced earlier this month when he said his administration was in the process of considering how soon the U.S. could lift the ban on European travel bound for the U.S. after the issue was raised by German Chancellor Angela Merkel during her visit to the White House. New York City will require nearly all municipal workers to get vaccinated by September or undergo weekly coronavirus test. AP correspondent Julie Walker.
Mayor Bill de Blasio says the vaccine mandate starts September 13th.
Every single city employee will be expected to be either vaccinated or be tested weekly. This means everybody.
He says the city tried purely voluntary for over half a year and every form of incentive. The limit was reached. It's time for more mandates, and he's urging the private sector to do the same.
This is about our recovery. This is about what we need to do to bring back New York City. This is about keeping people safe.
De Blasio says 71% of adults in the city have had at least one dose of the vaccine. Julie Walker, New York.
And California leaders have also said they are issuing a similar mandate. Pope Francis has decried as criminal the existence of hunger in the world, which can produce enough food for all. The pontiff was building on a warning sounded earlier Monday by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres that climate change and conflict are a consequence and a driver of poverty and income inequality. Guterres also told a meeting in Rome that the world's food system generates a third of all greenhouse gas emissions. The Rome event was designed to help prepare for a UN Food Systems Summit that occurring in September in New York. A UN report this month said millions more people faced hunger last year compared to 2019 before the coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic. There is more at voanews.com. Via remotes, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tanzanian authorities charge opposition leader with financing terrorism.
This evening, Mr. Freeman Mbowe, the leader of the opposition in Tanzania and Chadema chairman, has been charged by the police in Tanzania with terrorism.
Tunisia's president suspends parliament and dismisses the prime minister. Mozambique's president welcomes SADC troops in his country. Zambia's main opposition demands an inquiry into allegations that it is recruiting supporters for violence ahead of the August election. And today is the first face-to-face meeting between Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara and former President Laurent Gbagbo.
If they have to talk about the reconciliation, I think Ouattara and Gbagbo will talk about specific issues such as the return of the exiles, the release of prisoners.
And the trial of Nigeria's separatist leader took an unexpected turn yesterday, Monday. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tanzania, the Central Committee of the main opposition Chadema party will meet today, Tuesday, to consider the next move after Tanzania authorities on Monday charged party chairman Freeman Mbowe with economic sabotage, conspiracy, and financing terrorist activities. Mbowe and other party leaders were arrested last Wednesday in Mwanza as the party was preparing to hold a conference to demand constitutional reforms. The police said the gathering was illegal, but after searching Mbowe's home in Dar es Salaam, the police said Mbowe was arrested for his connection to terrorism. John Nrema is Chadema's Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols.
This evening, Mr. Freeman Mbowe, the leader of the opposition in Tanzania and Chadema chairman, has been charged by the police in Tanzania with terrorism. The charges are on terrorism that somewhere in Moshi last year in August, just before the campaign, we had a conspiracy to support a group of three people to do terrorist things. That's the charges they have charged him with this evening in Dar es Salaam. They arrested him in Mwanza a few hours before a new constitutional reform symposium in Mwanza. He was arrested him with other 15 people. Other 14 people were not charged until today, but they singled out himself and charged him with terrorism, which is unbailable in Tanzania law, so he is now behind the bars in one of the prisons in Dar es Salaam with maximum security.
Exactly. As you said, this is unbailable, so I was just about to ask you, what is the next step for Chadema?
First of all, today he was brought to the court without even the family or Chadema lawyers being informed. Chadema lawyers with the family, they were with Mr. Mbowe at the police station in Oysterbay today. Mr. Mbowe asked the police to take him to the hospital. The police said, yes, okay, we are now taking him to the hospital. But unfortunately, they didn't brought him to the hospital. They took him straight to the court without even the defense lawyers present. And then they charged him. In less than 15 minutes, they just took him to the prison. The next move for Chadema is that our lawyers, they are still struggling to get the charge sheet, the whole charge sheet, so that they can know exactly what they can advise us to do. But on our side, we are holding our central committee meeting tomorrow afternoon, East African time, and then they will deliberate on the matter. And they will issue directives to the party members and the general public. What next are we going to do as Chadema?
What does all this mean for the opposition? Because Tanzania has had a new president. What do you make of what's happening under President Samia Suluhu?
First of all, is that in the first 100 days of new President Samia Suluhu Hassan, even as we thought that she started very well, she was preaching about freedom, democracy, free media, and we thought she's going on the right direction. But at the moment, we are not quite sure, but we can say one thing, that she inherited the Magufuli system. The prime minister is the same person who was advising Magufuli way back then. The attorney general is the same. Inspector general of police is the same. Chief of intelligence and security services is the same. The cabinet ministers, the exception of three of them, all others are the same. So she is advised by the same people who were advising Magufuli way back then. That's why she's going the Magufuli.
John Nrema is Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition Chadema party. You are speaking with us from Dar es Salaam. The Speaker of the Tunisian Parliament and some lawmakers from his party were prevented from entering the Parliament building by soldiers of the National Army on Monday. This after President Kais Saied suspended the legislature, citing Article 80, a constitutional provision that grants him power to suspend the lawmaking body. The president also dismissed Prime Minister Hichem Mechichi. The move followed nationwide protests over economic challenges facing the country. Tarek Halawid is a political analyst and history professor at the Mediterranean School of Business in the Tunisian capital, Tunis. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the political challenges facing the country appear to have been compounded due to the absence of a constitutional court.
Well, after the decision by the president, Kais Saied, to activate the clause 80 in the Tunisian constitution, basically his interpretation of that clause is to stop any activities in the parliament. So the speaker of the parliament, early in the morning, he went there, and he was denied entry by an army contingent that was behind the main gate of the parliament. And he talked to them and with other MPs that are from his party or party in his alliance. And he was denied entry by the army. And the army said, or the soldiers who were there, responded that they are following instructions from the president himself.
Some people are accusing the president of staging a coup. Is that criticism justified?
Well, it's really highly complicated. If we follow the very detailed, basically, understanding of Clause 80, clearly the president's interpretation is a little bit expansive. He went really beyond at some points. So he went beyond what's written down, what's inscribed in the Constitution. And that's why he was characterized, what he did was characterized by a constitutional coup, using the Constitution to basically impose a new political situation. But here we have to take into account the political parties that were in Parliament before the new president came in 2019 were part of this problem, that they did not really activate so many clauses. And the most important clause is to establish a constitutional court. If the constitutional court was established on time, and that should have happened in 2015, all of this wouldn't be happening in this way. So the absence of a constitutional court is an essential problem, but it precedes the president's latest decision.
How are people reacting to the latest political activity? Because there is so much uncertainty, some people are suggesting.
Well, we have here to mention the wave of protestations and street demonstrations that happened yesterday in the morning and during the day against the government. And they were calling clearly for the resignation of the prime minister and also for the dissolution of the parliament. Many people actually attacked the headquarters of the most important party, the party with the largest majority, a Nahda party, an Islamist party. They attacked their headquarters in different cities. So when the president announced his decisions, his interpretation of Clause 80, people went to the streets celebrating not only in the capital, but also in so many other cities in Tunisia. So there is a wave of support for these decisions. Doesn't mean that this wave of support is going to continue, depending really on how the president is going to be effective, how much support he's going to get from other democratic parties and national organizations. And so we're going to see how this is going to be developing in the coming days.
Tarek Halawi is a political analyst and history professor at the Mediterranean School of Business in the Tunisian capital, Tunis. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Mozambique's President Filipe Nyusi has welcomed African troops sent to fight insurgents in the country's northern Cabo Delgado province. Members of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, in June committed to restore peace and stability to the province after insurgents attacked the town of Palma and began beheading villagers. Attacks since 2017 have killed nearly 3,000 people and displaced more than 800,000, as Charles Maguiru reports from Maputo.
Speaking live on Mozambique state media Sunday night, President Filipe Nyusi welcomed military support from African countries to fight its northern insurgents. In his first public confirmation of the foreign troops in the country, Nyusi said Rwandan military and police have been on the ground since July 9.
O mesmo tipo de contato estabelecemos com Kenya, Uganda, e Rwanda.
He says they know their countries that faced terrorism before and managed it well, and others are managing it. So they wouldn't want to lose the opportunity to explore these experiences. Many countries express the will and availability to help our country, says Nyusi. Partners like the United States of America, France, Russia, and Algeria also offer to help with training, advice, as well as drafting strategies to fight terrorism. Botswana on Monday announced it was sending nearly 300 troops to support Mozambique's own forces in fighting the insurgents. Despite Islamic State-linked militants terrorizing Mozambique's gas-rich north since 2017, Nyusi has been reluctant to ask for outside help. That changed after March when the armed Islamists attacked the town of Palma in Cabo Delgado province and beheaded villagers. Some 80,000 people fled the area and fears were raised that the unrest could spread. Neighboring countries began pressing Nyusi to accept foreign troops, and in June, the Southern African Development Community, SADC, agreed its member nations' troops would help restore peace and stability. Political analyst with Imani Development Consultancy, Egidio Vash, notes that not all 16 SADC members are likely to send troops to Mozambique.
The first reason is that you can't fight the terrorists with regular forces. You need specialized forces. So not every country has that. Not even Mozambique had it. So you can't expect, for example, Malawi has an anti-terrorist unit. You can't expect Eswatini, Lesotho. You can't expect even Namibia.
While the total size of the SADC deployment is not yet clear, the 16-member group sent officers this month to assess the situation. Special representative of the SADC standby state mission in Mozambique, Mpo Umolomo, arrived Thursday in Maputo and spoke to the press before traveling to Cabo Delgado.
Our intent as a region is that for us to develop, there must be peace and stability. And we are very much aware that instability in Mozambique is instability or will destabilize the entire Southern African region.
The militants, who call themselves Al-Shabaab, but have no apparent link to the Somali terrorist groups of the same name, forced their suspension of the major gas exploration project. French energy group Total in late April withdrew all its staff working on one U.S. $20 billion natural gas project site after insurgency attacks. Mozambique's gas projects in the region are worth about U.S. $60 billion. Charles Manguiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 27. In Zambia, the main opposition United Party for National Development, the UPND Alliance, is demanding an independent and thorough investigation into allegations that it has recruited 60,000 youths to engage in violence in a run-up to the August 12th general election. This after Antonio Mwanza, media director for the governing Patriot from PF Party, accused the UPND Alliance of engaging in violence to force a unity government after the election. But Thabo Kawana, the spokesperson for the UPND Alliance, denied the accusation as false. Kawana tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the Inspector General of Police and other security agencies should undertake an official inquiry.
Now, we had a seriously astonishing accusation and claim by the Patriotic Front through their media director, accusing us of training 60,000 militia in Lusaka in readiness for this activity during the election. Now, that is rather unfortunate, at the same time astonishing and laughable at the same time. We say so because how can 60,000 people be recruited and the police inspector general of police is unaware and the intelligence services of the nation are unaware and the President of the Republic is unaware when this activity is purported to have been taking place in the capital city of Lusaka. Yet only the PF are aware. And that is why we challenge the Inspector General of Police to summon Mr. Antonio Mwanza, so that he may furnish with the police with information as to where those 60,000 young people have been camped, recruited, and been trained into being militia.
There have been instances where there have been clashes between supporters of the UPND alliance and cadres or supporters of the Patriotic Front. But a lot of people are saying, including the PF, that the UPND alliance supporters are to blame for this ongoing violence. How do you address that concern and accusation?
It is correct to say that the PF is claiming that the alliance members are to blame, and the PF surrogates are claiming that it's the alliance members to blame. But what is correct to state and what is on record is that all these clashes that happen at a time when the UPND alliance is out campaigning and the PF go to interfere. So I repeat, and I've always stated, there is no violence between the PF and the UPND, but there is violence on the UPND by the PF.
Will you say that the UPND alliance is demonstrating commitment to the recent pledge to ensure its members do not engage in acts of violence in the run-up to the election or during the election process?
The UPND has not only demonstrated commitment to the pledge that was recently signed, the UPND has demonstrated its desire not to engage in violence from inception. And we have had a consistent message to our cadres not to engage in violence, even under heavy provocation. What is happening is that when the UPND is carrying out an activity in a neighborhood or an area, when the PF come to disrupt that activity, the residents in that area rise and begin to beat up the PF cadres. That is where the issue is.
Thabo Kawana is the spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition UPND alliance. You are speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara will today, Tuesday, have the first face-to-face meeting with former President Laurent Gbagbo. Gbagbo returned to Ivory Coast June 17 this year from Brussels, where he had been since his acquittal in April this year by the International Criminal Court, the ICC, for crimes against humanity allegedly committed during Ivory Coast post-election violence. Ouattara and Gbagbo led competing factions during Ivory Coast 2010-2011 post-election conflict. Today's meeting had been promoted as part of President Ouattara's efforts to promote national reconciliation. Journalist Felix Boni in Abidjan says if the two leaders are to talk about reconciliation, it would most likely center on the return of exiles, the release of political prisoners, and the transparency of upcoming elections in Cote d'Ivoire.
This meeting between these two leaders is not dedicated to the process of reconciliation, but in the current context, I think it counts among the acts expected to stimulate reconciliation in Cote d'Ivoire. Otherwise, it is an opportunity for Mr. Gbagbo to go and greet the President Ouattara, who created the condition for him to return home last June in Cote d'Ivoire. So it is not dedicated especially for reconciliation. We have not to expect those two personalities to speak about reconciliation, but it is not excluded that this reunion addresses the issue of reconciliation and some same thing in this direction.
The Ivory Coast government says the purpose of the meeting is part of the national reconciliation process initiated by President Ouattara. What do you think will be considered true reconciliation between President Ouattara and former President Gbagbo?
If they have to talk about reconciliation, I think Ouattara and Gbagbo will talk about specific issues such as the return of the exiles, the release of prisoners, and they will speak about some questions like their own political future, the condition of the upcoming election, and the transparency of this election, and even why not the reorganization of the electoral system. I think these are the questions which create problems in Cote d'Ivoire.
Felix, former President Gbagbo has also been meeting with other members of the opposition, such as Mr. Bédier. But it seems the former President Gbagbo has to work a little harder to bring about reconciliation within his own party. What can you tell us?
Really, Mr. Gbagbo has a great problem. It is the reconciliation inside his own party. And if he cannot make reconciliation in his own party, I don't think he will be able, will be very strong to make reconciliation with the other leaders, because he has to make reconciliation to success in reconciliation in his own party before trying to speak at the national level. And this is the real problem of Mr. Gbagbo at this moment. I think his first and real problem is begin by his own party before going to the national market.
That was journalist Felix Boni in the Ivorian capital, Abidjan. In Nigeria, the trial of Nnamdi Kanu, the leader of the indigenous people of Biafra, took an unexpected turn yesterday, Monday. The federal government failed to produce Kanu at the opening of court. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Abuja Federal High Court Judge Binta Inyako adjourned the trial on Monday after waiting hours for the state security services to provide Kanu, who has been in their custody since his rearrest late last month. Earlier, supporters, legal teams, and journalists were barred from entering the courtroom by security agents. Kanu was rearrested in Kenya on June 27, almost 4 years after he evaded arrest and secretly fled the country. He risks a death sentence for treason and other charges against him, which include terrorism and instigating public violence leading to loss of lives. Human rights lawyer Martin Obono says the government's hoarding of information about his arrest does not inspire confidence that he will receive a fair trial.
The circumstances surrounding his arrest are still as sketchy as they are. The government is supposed to be very, very open with this kind of information.
Nnamdi Kanu leads the decades-long agitation for a separate Biafran nation in Nigeria's southeastern region. The campaign triggered a civil war in the late 1960s, and an estimated 1 million people on the Biafran front were killed. On Monday, traders in the large southeastern Aba market shut down their businesses in solidarity with the separatist leader. Obono says the region is at risk of tension or an insurgency if the trial is not properly handled.
If anything untoward happens to him, then the people of Biafra, I'm sure, will definitely react. I mean, everyone, we are the memory of Muhammadu Yusuf of Boko Haram is still very fresh in our minds. So we need to be, the states basically needs to be very, very careful.
Yusuf, Boko Haram's original leader, was killed by Nigerian police in July 2009. Nnamdi Kanu will remain in custody until his next court trial, despite concerns about his health raised by his legal counsel in court Monday. Meanwhile, Yoruba separatist leader Sunday Igboho, who was arrested in Benin last week, appeared in a Beninese court Monday. Nigerian authorities are trying to track down separatist leaders, but experts say that will not stem separatist movements. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
That was Greenpeace International Project Leader for the Congo Basin Forest, Irene Wabiwabitoko. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Kinshasa. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the youth-led uprisings we've seen across Africa in recent years. As young people take to the streets and social media to demand change, we ask, have they been effective and what have the mass uprisings really accomplished? Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most serious seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.